And good afternoon, listeners. This is the Right Stream Radio Network, and you are listening to Military Monday. I am your host, John Gresham, and it is a beautiful, feels like fall day here in Northern Virginia, specifically Fairfax. The weather has turned. We can feel the snap. The sugars in the leaves are going to start turning various colors here in the Mid-Atlantic, and we're going to have my favorite time of year, football season. Well, fall. Anyway, as we come up here on the beginning of the new television season, as well as big release dates for movies that were in the theaters over the spring and summer, you would have to be half past dead not to have noticed the influence of comic books, particularly comic book storylines and characters, on our mass media. And why shouldn't it? Two or three, actually, of the biggest films this year, Spider-Man, Guardians of the Galaxy, and Captain America, Winter Soldier, all are based upon Marvel Universe comic characters. But a lot of people don't realize that there's a military tie-in with the comic book world, and it actually predates a lot of other people's recollections. In fact, it goes back a couple hundred years. And to talk to us today about comic books, propaganda, and the military, we have a gentleman who has written a book with our friends out at U.S. Naval Institute Press in Annapolis regarding comics and conflict. That is, in fact, the name of his book, Comics and Conflict. His name is Court Scott, and he is with us today. Court, are you there, sir?
I am indeed, and I thank you for having me on the show.
Amazing. For our listeners, I'm working with a bit of a internet technological lash-up today, so we're going to bet that our friends at my secondary internet sources can hold this together and we can have a whole hour doing this. Sir, where in the world did you start out becoming interested in comic books as more than just personal entertainment as a kid?
Oh, that's an interesting story. My brother and I, now me being a child of the 70s when the big G.I. Joes, the 12-inch high ones, came out, and my brother was a few years younger than I was, so he collected the smaller ones. He had started buying the figures. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, the smaller ones are known as action figures, yes.
Yes, yes. Well, they all are, but that's, you know, an interesting story of a side nature. But when the figures came out, I started collecting the comic books, and I was in my, you know, early teens at the time. And one of the first storylines that I had ever read about was an issue of G.I. Joe where they talked about the storming of the battleship Potemkin, and they had made a reference to it, and it was, you know, here I am reading this going, wait a minute, there's a historical reference in a comic book. That's kind of odd. So I found it interesting, but I didn't really think much more of it for a considerable amount of time. And what happened was is that I had eventually gone through my undergraduate education, and then I had done my master's work, which was in political science, and then I had started my teaching career, and through a long twisty route, I ended up going to a design college in Chicago. And I had just started my doctoral program at that time. And what happened was is that 9/11 came along. And I was teaching a class in propaganda and persuasion, specifically dealing with the visual elements. And as I was teaching the class and reading so much as everyone was of what was going on and how people were responding to the events, I had read that Marvel was going to release a special edition comic book, The Amazing Spider-Man number 36, which had an all-black cover. And what it dealt with was the idea that here you had a super character, or a superhero, somebody who, by their very nature, can stop all these, you know, figures and villains from around the world, but they couldn't stop this. And I found it intriguing, and I had run down to a comic book store to pick it up and just to see what was going on. And that it started this use in a classroom of propaganda from a comic book perspective. At the same point, I had brought back in the original image of Captain America from 1941, where he's punching out Hitler, and that became the impetus for what started as an element in a class to a paper that I had to write in a graduate class, which eventually led to a presentation, which led to another paper, which was published, which led into my dissertation, and eventually led into the book that you hold in your hands at this point. So it's kind of been a very slow process, but it's been one that's really has allowed me to look at things from an entirely different perspective. Very much a perspective that goes beyond the simple images on a page to what does it really mean in reference to cultural history, to military history, to the discussions of events in our times. So that's kind of how it ended up where it is now. So
okay, and where in that process does the book emerge, and how do you go? How do you go to one of the more distinguished military presses in the United States and say, hey, guys, I want to do a book about propaganda and comics?
It was one that I had the fine folks at Pritzker Military Library in Chicago, where I had done some work on an exhibition involving war comic books, things that have been specifically produced for the military. One of their librarians, wonderful woman by the name of Terry Embry, had said, hey, you should really think about giving Naval Institute Press a call and see if they'd be interested in it. And that's basically what happened. I can't say enough about the Naval Institute Press. They've been wonderful. They've been, extremely helpful throughout the process. This book, it fits into a rather odd niche, but it's an interesting niche because I spend a lot of time talking about World War II comics, but at the same point, this book goes literally up to about 2010. So it even talks about, war comics that have come out that have either dealt with World War II but in a modern setting that post-Saving Private Ryan realism that everybody's trying to go for in a lot of military-themed media, as well as some of the military-produced comics and that have tried to help everybody with things like maintenance, or another one that just came out not really recently, but a few years ago, was a comic that was done that dealt with post-traumatic stress and what to look for within a returning soldier so that they can recognize what might be more than just simply reacclimation into a civilian life, but what might be considered, something more severe.
And with that, let's start talking about comics, because obviously what we're talking about is, in the media speak that you and I work in, we're talking about visual storytelling. We're going and taking advantage of the fact that people have eyeballs, and that visually speaking, notwithstanding the differences that we discuss between men and women, the visual is very powerful in human beings, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you can go back, go back to the Roman era and you look at some of the stelae that are there, and what does it have? It often has, members of the Roman legions in very heroic poses doing things that are of a very visual nature. Not everybody can read, but everybody can identify the pictures. They can identify the events surrounding them. So that, it's a very simple, but it's a very understated and powerful way of getting your point across. So, and it's one that's been around for thousands
of
years.
For a long time. I mean, I still remember as a kid looking at the National Geographic of those amazing cave paintings in France that we're all familiar with. This comics are not new. We didn't invent them. I mean, in fact, it's hard to tell who got the idea of taking some mud or some blood or something and you know, drawing a picture on a wall somewhere.
Absolutely. You know, in addition to the cave paintings, you often look at, you know, just simple ways of training military personnel by just simply showing them how to handle a weapon. You know, it's often done through a visual medium. You know, so, but it's quite amazing in its own right. You know, how you can go back and see so much of this throughout history. One of the books that I had ran across in my research dealt with the concept of, even in the 1500s when they would have public executions in England, they would do visual characterizations for them to get people to come out and see the beheadings. You know, so it's a rather interesting, you know, we talk about violence in media and we go, you know, some people are offended by the fact that we are a very violent society. Unfortunately, that violence has been there for a very long period of time. It's part of the human condition. So,
and let's face it, it's not like we've become more humane in the 500 to 600 years that visual media has become generally available. And let's talk about that period, because somewhere out there, a guy named Gutenberg came up with a printing press and started going and printing, you know, started with Bibles, but before long, some idiot got the idea that people might want to know what was happening in the next town over, or maybe in London. And so we got newspapers and magazines. And somewhere in the middle of it, somebody said, wouldn't a picture be nice? Take it from there to say, oh, the middle of the 19th century.
Well, you get the concept of the political cartoons, which are often meant as satire as well as discussing the conditions of what's going on in society. One of the most famous early political cartoons would be that of Ben Franklin from 1754, I believe it was. It was the Join or Die cartoon with the snake being chopped up into small sections. The idea is that, look, if we're going to fight together as a unified nation, we've got to do it in such a manner that we're all in this together. And that political cartoon was very much part of that tradition.
The idea that if we do not hang together, we will surely hang separately.
Exactly. There are some rather interesting political cartoons that were done concerning the War of 1812, the idea that you had both sides, both the British and the Americans, were using the Indians as agent provocateurs, so to speak, or mercenaries, if you will, and because of their vicious nature within the war, they often would show, you know, satirical cartoons of Indians scalping people, and the idea that both sides either utilized this aspect of warfare or condoned it, and the political cartoons were a way of making commentary on those, you know, events. So you do see it a considerable amount, you know, as far as the political cartoons are concerned, going into the 1850s and 60s, when you have, well, specifically during the Civil War, you actually had combat sketch artists going out with some of the newspapers doing drawings of the battles themselves. And then right after after the war, you have Thomas Nast, probably one of the most famous political cartoonists of any era, you know, the guy who gives us the elephant for the Republican Party, and the idea of the Tammany tiger, the idea of Tammany Hall and the corruption within the New York political system as well. So, I mean, the idea is that, again, these images can be very, very powerful, very simple. In fact, William Tweed, the boss of Tammany Hall in the 1870s, he despised Nash. He said, look, I don't care about what people read about me, but I can't stand them damned pictures, because people could instantly recognize the image of Tweed and his corruption. You know, so again, the imagery itself is very powerful, very telling. So,
okay, and we continue on after the Civil War, and the quality as well as the editorial content of political and other cartooning is becoming quite sophisticated, and it's also competing with a new visual medium called photography. So it tends to carve out its niche, and photography and eventually movies begin to carve out its niches. And somewhere after World War I, somebody gets the idea of a hybrid of a story, a complete story being told front to back, but doing so visually with cartoons. Talk about the development of the comic book.
Okay. Well, the comic book itself starts out of the comic strips, and the strips come in the late 1890s. You know, they're mostly attributed to Oatkalt, who had done The Yellow Kid for the New York Herald in 1896. And when this continues on, this eventually leads into the Cats and Jammer Kids here in Chicago. It leads to Indian Summer, one of the first published comic strips, and Mutt and Jeff. Now, a lot of these are very simple. They're three-panel sequential, drawings which give some sort of a setup, a punchline, and some sort of, gag for the reader to look at. Along this line, you also start getting the development of cartoons, which come in from a guy by the name of Winsor McCay, is the one who's most often attributed with the origins of the cartoon. Winsor McCay, interestingly enough, did one of the first political cartoons, as in moving pictures, which was The Sinking of the Lusitania. He did it actually, the cartoon came out in 1918, and the cartoon itself lasts about as long as the time it took for the real Lusitania to sink. The cartoon's like something like 14 minutes, and the sinking went down in like 18. So now, by the 1920s, you start seeing the cartooning coming into its own, and the comic strips continuing on. And what happened is, in the mid 1930s, you get a guy by the name of Max Gaines, who will decide to reprint some of these comic strips into a piece of newsprint that has been folded 8 times. So, and that gives us the comic book shape that we see now. And what happens is they go through, they look at this, and they go, oh, okay, this is a great idea, and we'll print it and sell it for a dime, and kids will buy it everywhere during the Depression. Something to look at. Very quickly, people start to realize, wait a minute, we can maybe design, pull up, make our own characters, start tweaking these ideas and really start coming up with something a little bit more substantial. This is where you get, by 1937, you get the, National Comics, which eventually becomes DC. They'll introduce Batman in late 37. Then in 1938, you get Superman coming in. And then from that, it's a slew of just general comic book companies all over the place. Obviously, a lot of them focused in the New York City area. But they try a lot of these different formulas. Let's try this guy. Give him superpowers. Let's give this guy superpowers. Let's try all this stuff to see what works and what doesn't. Fair amount of these companies don't last very long. Some of the characters might only last a couple of issues just because of the fact that they don't resonate with the readership. Others, however, they're off to the races. They're just instantly popular, Superman being one, Captain Marvel being another one. And then finally, the one that became kind of the focal point for my book, which was Captain America. So he wasn't necessarily the first patriotically themed superhero, nor was he the last, but he was the one that had the most longevity, shall we say.
A question that comes up here, obviously we see the emergence of this new media. God, imagine talking about a newsprint with a cardboard cover being considered new media 80 years ago, but it was. How did the Depression that the country had gone through over the previous decade affect both the nature of the superheroes that were being created in the comics and how the public viewed them? What was it that the public wanted from these characters to go and entertain them and maybe do something more?
Well, they want escapism, for one. You know, it's like with movies from that same 1930s, you know, venue. It's a way to escape what's going on for the troubles around us. You know, it's a way to see somebody, the issues of right defeating the evil of the world around us. One thing that's rather interesting and somewhat odd is the fact that Superman actually took on companies that were going against strikers in the 1930s. So Superman is almost kind of a socialist in some regards, which is kind of, I mean, by today's standards, you wouldn't think of any comic book hero as necessarily being political, but he kind of was in that regard. So you have that issue. At the same point, you know, it's the traditional story of somebody fighting for what is right within society. You go against, you know, the cops and robbers motif, where you go against the bad guys. You go against the ones who are taking advantage of the weak or less, you know, those less likely to defend themselves. And that's where the superhero comes in. He's the person who's going to fight for those who can't necessarily fight for themselves. So, and for some characters, it was the idea that readers could relate to them. Captain Marvel, was a kid who, you know, could say the magic word Shazam and turn into a superhero. You know, you had Superman is, in fact, you know, he's an alien of sorts, but because of the fact that, you know, within alienation within a society, people can relate to that. They can go, well, you know, I know what it's like to be the outsider that nobody wants to hang out with. And in a roundabout, that's what Superman really is. You know,
let's
you
see
have
outbreak
some
two in Europe. Did we see these characters becoming engaged in the European war, or did the comic book producers remain isolationist up until Pearl Harbor?
That's another interesting story. The one, again, that goes back to this is Captain America. Captain America actually, when a comic book comes out, it has a date on it, and that date is somewhat circumspect because of the fact that there's always, well, you know, they're fudging it a couple of months because that way they can keep it on the racks a little longer. But when Captain America came out, it was, you know, early 1941 when the U.S. is officially still isolationist. So here you've got a character who is, interestingly enough, a Nazi ideal, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy who very strong, very tall. But at the same point, here he is punching out Hitler on that very first cover. The comic book creators at that point, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, who are incidentally Jewish, and they caught a lot of hell for that because of the fact that the German-American Bund actually made threats against them for drawing Captain America early on, they're taking a stand that most Americans don't want to. So again, it's the idea of maybe not necessarily pushing for the United States to get involved in the war, but you could definitely see that Hitler was an evil guy. He makes a great villain. Let's go with that. So it just kind of, in a roundabout way, it is pushing for U.S. entry into the war, but it's doing so in a way that is definitely ahead of the curve. It, you know, most Americans had no inclination towards necessarily getting involved in the war. As far as the other characters are concerned, you do see an undertone of a lot of people with anti-communist sentiments. A lot of the military characters that are drawn within the early Captain America storylines, the uniforms are very, very Soviet-looking. They're called the individuals are called Moskonians, so it's got that anti-communist bent to it as well. The Japanese do figure into a lot of the storylines. They often, you know, they go back to the very base racial stereotypes: buck teeth, Coke bottle glasses, very vicious in their treatment of anybody who is not them. You know, so there is that element of introducing modern political, what was then modern political enemies, introducing them into the comic book landscape as a way of kind of getting a topicality to it that the readers could see. They could go, oh, okay, I've heard about this in the news. Now here it is in a comic book format. You know, okay, kick their ass. Go from there.
Out of curiosity, all the characters are white. Most of them are male. I mean, as far as the heroes of these things. So it's reflecting the nature and makeup of the power structure in society to a great degree.
Yes, very much so. If you go through and look at a lot of the comic books from that time frame, if you do see depictions of any minorities, they often will go back to stereotypes. If you were to read a lot of the comic books from then, if you were to read them now, you would probably have the same reaction I did, which is like, wow, I can't believe they actually did that. This is incredibly offensive. But at the time, it was perfectly acceptable. There was one, the creators of Captain America ended up creating a group called the, not the Boy, they created the Boy Commandos as well, but they did another one called the Young Allies. And the Young Allies all came about, and they had one character who was African-American named Whitewash Jones, who his talent was playing a harmonica and eating watermelon. And you're just reading this going, oh, my, you know, how can anybody produce something like this? But, you know, it's the era of the time. And so, yeah, you get a lot of the characters are definitely white. They may not identify themselves as specific religion, but it's often implied that they are Protestant in some form or another. But it's very much part of that structure of the 1940s where it is, yeah, white male. So.
And then comes Pearl Harbor, and what happens? Because it's fast. It happens really fast.
As far as the comic books are concerned, there had been a few comics that had come out prior to this saying, well, the U.S. is ready. You know, they would talk about how the American military is preparing for a possible conflict and things like that. Pearl Harbor happens. A couple of comic books come out not long after, one of which is called Remember Pearl Harbor, and it's got Uncle Sam on the cover of it, and that's one of the images that's used in the book. It talks about the fact that this was a sneak attack. It was very vicious. Okay, now the war is on. Now you're going to get yours. So the idea is that everybody immediately rally around the flag and go forward. A lot of the comics right away start to take on this: what can you as a young child, what can you do for the war effort? So there was a comic book called How Boys and Girls Can Help Win the War, and it talked about things like recycling and saving fats for grease and, you know, saving aluminum for various items, newspapers, you know. And if you buy a war stamp or a war bond, this is what your war stamp or war bond will buy you. You know, 10 cents will buy you a clip of ammunition for a .45 caliber pistol. $1.60 will buy you a .45 caliber pistol, things of that nature. So, you know, so it was a way for, especially younger readers, it was a way for them to say, hey, I'm helping the effort. And at the same point, they could see kind of tangible results of what that money that they would give to the government, what it would help them out in the future. You know, and then you get groups like, you know, Captain America. They had the Sentinels of Liberty, where you could send in a dime and join the group, and you would be ever present, looking for, fifth column elements or enemies of the state or things of that nature. So, you know, again, it's
we're
going to
talk more
now
about World War II after our break, and we're going to talk about the fact that the comics become a tool. They also become a source of material, content, if you will, for other media. But let's go ahead and take our break. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Right Stream Radio Network.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity, Be sure to follow us on Twitter at WriteStream and hashtag WriteStream. Thanks for listening to the WriteStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the WriteStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for WriteStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. WriteStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. WriteStream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the WriteStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to WriteStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the WriteStream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorist, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can, but we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives, and for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And we are back. It is Military Monday. I am your host, John Gresham, and our guest today is Mr. Cord Scott, and we're talking about comics and how they fit into war, for lack of a better term. We're using that word this week, aren't we, Cord? War. War is the word of the week.
It is indeed.
And one thing is for certain. When the comic books went to war in 1941, nobody was worrying about the word or the spelling. We knew who the bad guys were, and we had lots of them. Talk a little bit about what happened print-wise to our superheroes, Superman and Captain America and Captain Marvel. What happens to these guys? Do they all rush down to the draft board and enlist? How do they wind up doing that voodoo they did in World War II?
That's a great story in and of itself. You have, first off, Captain America is a private, as they showed in the movie, in the U.S. military. He ends up going through this experimentation program, so he ends up being a soldier, but what's rather interesting is, just as the movie did, the movie was a really nice adaptation of the original storyline. And what he ended up doing was, he became so valuable they didn't want to use him in the exact front line. So they used him as kind of a, as a way of rooting out spies and fifth column elements in the United States. Superman, that's probably one of the best hooks ever. There were a lot of younger readers who, they read Superman, they go, hey, why isn't, Superman going over and, taking on all these Nazi divisions and, beating on the SS or whoever. And the writers themselves kind of realized, this is probably not good because we're giving the kids false hope. So what they did was they wrote a storyline, into it, where Clark Kent goes down to his local draft board, and he wants to do the right thing. He wants to join the military. And so they're like, okay, read the eye chart. And in his excitement, he reads the eye chart with his X-ray vision two rooms over. And so the eye doctor's looking at him going, yeah, you can't see anything, bud. You're blind as a bat. 4F, go away. And while Clark Kent was rather upset by this, and a lot of people saw him as maybe not doing the greater good for the Republic, this way, from the writer's standpoint, Superman can continue to stay in the United States, fight the enemies of the United States within the United States, and leave the real fighting to, soldiers and airmen and Marines and naval personnel overseas. So it's rather interesting how some of the characters developed. Some of them were, had the most mild-mannered origins. Probably one of the more bizarre ones from Marvel was a mild-mannered history instructor who ended up becoming, first it was Mr. Liberty and then it was Major Liberty, but yet he fought in a Revolutionary War outfit complete with roughly ascot. And I'm like, no, I'm just not buying that one. And it didn't last very long. Other characters, came in, and one was a Marine who donned a superhero guise and went out and fought and then went back to being a regular Marine. So that's kind of an interesting take on everything. But for the most part, the characters themselves didn't fight directly in the war, especially for the major comic books. Now, there were some comic books that did take real events and make the characters into comic book heroes, one of which, I'm working on another project right now, and if you've ever seen The Pacific, the series that came out from HBO in 2010, they reference a comic book story involving John Bassalone. That did, in fact, occur, and I actually have that issue, and so I was doing some research on it. And it made for some great story, and at the same point, kids could read some of these comic books and go, oh, okay, well, these are real heroes. These are real things that are being done that have military, maybe not significance, but at least they would recognize the military stories within them and know that they were real and not just, you know, fantasy. So, but it's kind of interesting. There were some real changes in the way that the comic books themselves were created. A lot of the comic book creators, they either out of patriotism joined or they were drafted in some cases. The one guy who's, or the two names that really often come up associated with kind of bridging from the civilian market into the military one is Milton Caniff, who people might know of because of the fact that he did Terry and the Pirates and later on Steve Canyon. Caniff himself couldn't serve in the military. He was a little too old and he had bad knees, but he ended up drawing a series called Mail Call, M-A-L-E Call, and it involved a character by the name of Miss Lace, who was a very voluptuous woman who would like to go out and hang out specifically with enlisted personnel and make them feel good. It was, you know... And then Caniff himself had also done a small section called How to Spot a Jap, which was featured in the Serviceman's Guide to China. And it was a way of distinguishing through physical traits the difference between Japanese and Chinese personnel. Again, you look at it and read it and just kind of cringe because now it would be very politically incorrect, but at the time it was perfectly acceptable. The other guy who comes into mind is Will Eisner. Eisner had been responsible for the Spirit and before the war, and he joined the war and then took his cartooning skills to Aberdeen, to the Ordnance Division, and ended up revamping Army Motors. And he created a character by the name of Joe Dope. And these were a series of cartoon or comic strips which said, look, this is what not to do with your equipment. Treat your equipment right, and it will serve you well in combat. That, for those of your listeners who might be familiar with it, Army Motors eventually evolved into what became PS Magazine, still produced by the U.S. Army. And so Eisner had a very long career of continuing on with his own comic books, but also doing a lot of comics for the U.S. military, training, indoctrination, things of that nature. So,
all right. And at the same time, not to forget the origins that we talked about originally, there is a lively editorial and some would say steam-blowing function that comics and cartoons have. Obviously, editorial cartooning back in the States continues, albeit somewhat more patriotically and supportive of the war effort than it was before Pearl Harbor. But in the middle, there's a couple of really interesting people doing some first-class work. And let's talk about Bill Malden.
Excellent. Always the guy to look at. Malden's illustrations of Willie and Joe, which appear in Stars and Stripes, great way for the average soldier to vent his issues he might have with whether it's the physical conditions of the terrain, like the fighting in Italy, or the idea of the one cartoon that he had with the Guerra troopers, the guys who were back from the lions who were looking tougher than they actually are, which was seen as a bit of an insult to those who really were on the front line, to the ever-famous illustration of a guy looking at the, you're entering the Third Army area, you know, no shave, no tie, no sir, and the officer on the radio saying, yeah, we got a 1,000-mile detour coming up because of, you know, the spit and polish aspect of a combat zone, you know, in relationship to what Malden didn't like involving Patton. So it's some great work, you know, absolutely, you know, it shows a democratization of the military because of the fact that here you have enlisted men who might be able to gripe about these issues, but they can do so in a way that is not going to necessarily get them formal reprimand. You know, Malden was one of...
Although Malden himself made a few enemies, not the least of which was the great general, blood and guts, George Patton, who apparently tried but failed to get action against him.
Yeah, he that was not one of those things where, you know, a lot of people were not happy with the way that Malden was treating, you know, some of these situations. But at the same point, you know, Malden had a lot of people who defended him as well, and you know, they recognized that the fact that this was an editorial comment rather than necessarily a complete destruction of the chain of command. You know, one of the other processes that I go through is looking at a lot of political and military cartoons from other countries as well. You do not see any sort of griping or any sort of questioning of the chain of command in a lot of other military cartoons. You know, the Germans certainly don't do it. The Japanese don't do it. You know, this is something that is somewhat unique to the American concept, and then it's emulated by the Canadians, by the British. You have some great crossovers of a lot of these design elements. In fact, the Canadians had a guy by the name of Lem Norris who actually took Eisner's stuff from Army Motors and completely he changed it, but at the same point he definitely kept that spirit and called it the Campaigns of Benny Boob. So it's like Joe Dope, except in reference to the Canadian military. And again, very popular, very, you know, it resonated with the troops because they could read the humor in it, but at the same point they could go, oh, okay, I understand what's going on. This guy's telling me in a humorous manner, don't, you know, maintain the weapon, maintain the vehicle, do this the way it should be, not the way I think it should be. So, yeah, it's some amazing stuff. And then you have, in addition to Malden, you have George Baker, who did Sad Sack, which came out in Yank magazine. You have Dave Brager, who did G.I. Joe, the earlier version during World War II. And then he actually did an offshoot for Stars and Stripes, also called G.I. Jerry, where he took the you know, what does the average German soldier think of what's going on, and, you know, kind of twisted that on its head, again, for comedic effect, but it was still something that was rather interesting. You can go through Stars and Stripes and Yank in particular and see a wide variety of cartoonists and illustrators who they're definitely taking that American concept of griping, of complaining, but at the same point being mindful of what's going on in the process as well. And it really makes for an interesting way to look at military history from World War II. You know, you see the complaints about how is this working or how is this not working. You can also see where some of the sparks of innovation come from. You know, it might have seemed rather a bit of a stretch, but you take something like some Rube Goldberg design of something that's abnormally complex and make it somewhat simple, you know, and then eventually you end up getting somebody like, you know, Sergeant Collins, who comes up with the hedgerow cutters when they're going through Normandy. You know, the idea that something, that innovation that is maybe not prevalent in say, like, you know, the German military at that time, certainly does have that element that sparks with the American military. So, and you know, it might be a stretch, but it still goes back to the comics and the idea that you can get people to vent their issues, their ideas, and, you know, have a good laugh in the process. So,
out of curiosity, again, how does the state of the art, which is to say the technique, the quality, the skill of the artists, improve during World War II? What innovations do we see in terms of cartooning and comics during this period?
Well, I mean, for the design elements, you see some who are still, you know, very much, you know, sketch artists. They're not doing a lot of really detailed work. Others who are trying to use that, the aspect of the comics or the comic illustrations, and they're trying to apply it to different venues. Here's another good one that, out of the middle of nowhere, if any you know, you take Ted Geisel, you know, Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss actually did a series of posters talking about, you know, how to combat malaria by taking your atrabine and by using your mosquito nets in the Pacific. Why? Because otherwise malaria could potentially kill you. You know, so it's the idea that you get not just an aspect of entertainment, but again, you go back to that idea of information, of indoctrination. Some of the ideas, you know, they might seem a bit flat now by comparison because they're not as well illustrated. But at the same point, we're looking at this from a 2014 perspective, where we're used to 3D graphics and, you know, state-of-the-art technology to help augment everything to make it more realistic. You know, the cartoonists back then, they're still looking for that simplistic element. You know, they're definitely talking about the real things that are going on, but, you know, they want to have that connection, but at the same point, they want to have a humorous element to it. Another one that I have from my personal collection, which has gotten rather large over the years, is it was actually a restricted comic book entitled Tokyo Straight Ahead, and it was done by the Marine Corps. And the whole thing talked about, in a humorous format, you know, things like, you know, prevention against VD, which can make you ineffective as a combatant, the idea of taking care of your weapon, the idea of, you know, tricks of the Japanese, so the idea that you have to be on your toes at all time lest something bad happen to you. You know, so it's, again, it's the idea of a humor, but it's definitely with a very serious undertone to a lot of it, which is, you know, amazing in its own right. And I'll have to admit, in some regards, I've just barely scratched the surface with a lot of the stuff that's out there. I mean, I have a pretty large collection of a lot of this stuff, but every day I come across something that's completely new. In fact, just this morning I ended up getting in the mail a couple of cartoon scenarios that were done by the Presidio. And they were dated from 1951, so it was how to deal with teaching language elements in Russian to people who might end up in a concentration camp or some sort of a gulag system were being interrogated by Russians in 1951 during the Korean War. So it's, you know, you definitely see that element of comics and cartoons in a wide variety of places that are certainly always coming out of nowhere, it seems like.
During World War II, obviously there was probably some coordination with the organization known as the Office of War Information. But did the comic book producers ever deal with more clandestine people like General Donovan and the OSS?
The one item that I could see that would kind of fit into a comic book but not well, which would deal with the OSS, would be the use of the Liberator pistols, the really cheaply made ones, stamped ones that were dropped, that the clandestine groups might be able to use. You don't.
Yeah, fire 145 bullet, kill a German, take his gun, and then hand the Liberator to another plucky little Maquis.
Exactly. As far as a lot of the OSS stuff directly, I have not run across it. It doesn't mean that it's not out there, but I haven't run across anything. I do know that the USIS did eventually start making a lot of comics that dealt with aspects of, you know, either political issues in different parts of the world. There's a great one online that actually ended up being how to be an effective counter-terrorist in Nicaragua in the mid-1980s, which was rather an interesting one. And again,
imagine
look at
that.
It,
I wonder who possibly would have asked for something like that.
It's some neat stuff to look at. You look at it now and you just kind of think, well, maybe this would work, maybe this wouldn't, but it is interesting. and it was done as a way to, again, for people who are not well educated, it would be a very simple way to convey a thought process, you know, and that's kind of always been the rather interesting but rather odd aspect of comic books. People often associate them with smaller children. And in some regards, that was a target audience at one point. But when they started off, they were actually meant for a little older audience. They've kind of ebbed and flowed. I mean, your average comic book reader now is in his mid-20s and has a bit more disposable income. But the situation now, in 2014, there's a lot more media to compete with. Whereas back then when comic books initially came out, you know, that was a rather interesting niche market that did reach a pretty wide amount of people. And it was a great way for both education and information and entertainment. So
the war ends and peace is restored, or so we think. But we enter the Cold War. And what do comics do during the Cold War? Because you've got this 50-year period, where we're sort of at war, but we're sort of not, thank goodness. And what happens to comics during things like Korea and Vietnam?
Well, the war comic genre comes in, and then it kind of, after World War II, it kind of dies off a bit. Some characters are eventually retired, replaced. Captain America himself, actually, he kind of, the sales fell in the late 40s. He was reintroduced in the early 50s, and then he just kind of went away for about, you know, 12, 14 years. You have some comic book companies very much doing the blood and guts, you know, it's gung-ho, everything's the way it is, and we need to fight for what's right in the world. Others try to take a bit more of a cerebral approach to it, might be a good way of putting it. The early ones from the 1950s, Two-Fisted Tales and Frontline Combat, both done by a company by the name of EC, which eventually became Mad Magazine, their stories, which were written and illustrated by a considerable amount of World War II vets, they were ones that dealt with the horrible nature of war. I mean, you would see in the illustrations in the comic books, you might see guys cracking under pressure. You would see somebody with a bullet hole in the helmet. You know, somebody did die, and it wasn't a glorious death. It was just dead. And that was something that they would try to get across in those storylines. And some of the comic books worked. Those two in particular, Frontline Comics or Frontline Combat and Two-Fisted Tales, they had a run of, you know, about 4 or 5 years, and they just kind of went away. Part of it was because of the fact that, you know, they didn't know what was going on. Some other companies, they do comic books that are definitely, you know, take out the Japanese, put in the Chinese communists, take out the Nazis, put in the Russians. It's the same thing. And some of those companies, you know, some of them lasted, some of them didn't. By the 1960s, you have some war comics that are trying to be a bit more factual. Again, the one that comes up during the early days of Vietnam is a comic book called Blazing Combat that was done by Warren. Again, very realistic. A lot of people didn't like it. In fact, the American Legion tried to ban the sales of Blazing Combat in a lot of the venues. So that one didn't last very long. You do have some of the 1960s, early 1970s comics, you know, Sergeant Rock, Enemy Ace, GI Combat, those coming from DC, they have a tendency to be a bit more reflective of the war. They talk about the idea of combat stress, but at the same point, it's still a very uplifting uplifting might be the wrong word to use, but it's just, it definitely a heroic tale. You know, Frank Rock and his, you know, his twin belts of 30 cal ammo running around with a Thompson, you know, it's great stuff. I loved it. I read it a lot when I was a kid, you know. A lot of people kind of derided it, especially by the time of Vietnam, going just, you know, this is not the reality of combat, especially in a place like Vietnam. People can't be Sergeant Rock because it's not going to work. It's going to get people killed. So you have this, you know, especially by the 1960s, you start to see more comic books starting to take on a bit more of a realistic element to it. You know, whether or not that's true realism or comic book realism is always subject to definition, but it's interesting. It really is. And then as far as the using the World War II storylines in a lot of the comic books, that goes back to a company called Dell in the 1960s. They would actually take major combat events from places like Guadalcanal or Montecassino or whatnot, and they'd put it into comic book format so, you know, younger readers could look at this stuff, read it, and go, okay, this is a base to work off of. Okay, now let me go get a real history book and start looking at the facts rather than necessarily the comic book version. But that's one of the reasons why I've always loved this stuff, because it's never meant to be history in and of itself, but it's a good starting point. And especially for younger readers, it's a way for them to understand what's going on. No, are they going to get the entire history? Absolutely not. But it's a place for them to start where they can go, oh, okay, now where do I go to get other history books to try to, you know, build up my knowledge of what's going on? So.
And you do see more Cold War-oriented themes. There's a whole thing called Terry and the Pirates and the world of the Far East post-World War II.
Yeah, it's some interesting stuff. Vietnam was kind of, the Vietnam concept isn't done extensively in a lot of war comics. You do see some stuff, guerrilla war, Tales of the Green Berets, things like that, but most of those issues only last 5, 10, maybe 15 issues, and then they kind of, again, drop off. So you do have that idea of trying to talk about what's going on in the world around us, but, you know, does it resonate with the readers? Not always. You know, in the 1960s, this is also because of the unrest, turmoil, whatever you want to call it, of the 1960s. This is where you get the comic books themselves, or the comic book creators start tweaking the ideas, and they start making characters that resonate more with an older audience. That's why Spider-Man comes out in the early 60s. The idea is that, you know, now teenagers can they can read this and relate to it because Peter Parker is a teenager. But I'm probably going off topic for a minute, so I apologize.
And we also see the U.S. Army, which is still a draft army, a citizen army. It finds itself in need of comics to help teach the new generation of soldiers, some of whom are not terribly well educated, many of whom do not have high school graduation in their background, how to operate some very, very complex equipment, including a new rifle called the M16 that, when fielded, does not work very well.
No. No, in fact, there you go again. That's the perfect link to all of this because, again, the maintenance manual for the how to manage your Sweet 16, you know, it is Will Eisner's brainchild. So he takes the characters, not Joe Dope, but he takes a couple of the other characters, including a voluptuous woman by the name of Connie Rodd, and he has her, you know, showing troops how to effectively maintain their M16 rifle. Again, this was the manual in reference goes back to PS Magazine, which is still produced. It's a great little digest that people can pick up and look at it, and you can read it, you know, how to use headspace on your M250 caliber machine gun, how to effectively maintain your M14 rifle, you know, which incidentally I ended up getting a copy from my dad because that was the first weapon he trained on when he was in the Army in the mid-60s. So, you know, it's interesting to see how all of this develops, you know, the idea of using a comic book as a way, as a training manual, you know. And one of the reasons why that was so successful for the Army was because of the fact that you could do illustrations that might not show up as well on a photograph. So Eisner, that was one of the reasons why Eisner liked to do the illustrations, because you could show things like, you know, the bolt carrier on the M16. This is what it should look like. This is where it fits in. This is how you take it out. You know, I read that manual and kind of went, oh, okay, I've never handled an M16, but I think I could figure this out pretty quickly because of this manual, because of the visual references. So it is a great effective way to at least start the process of educating soldiers who might not have that opportunity otherwise. And it's certainly,
now, it's worth noting that the characters in these maintenance manuals were almost Vargas girls in terms of their curves and exposure. Certainly the military does not tailor their uniforms, nor did they then, in any way like what was depicted. But it and politically correct people would absolutely be appalled by it, correct?
Yes, yes. In fact, if you pick up one of the modern ones, they still use female personnel in the storylines, but now everyone is dressed in, you know, proper military attire, and they're proportioned properly. It's you know, not what it once was, shall we say. So, but
you know, by the
still
way, the characters are not necessarily white and voluptuous, as you say.
No.
They look like the people in the Army now.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
Now, alongside the Army's comics and the comic book industry itself, we also see something else happening. Yes, it's editorial, but it's also a comic strip. And it's called Doonesbury, and it's created by a former Yale or Harvard, Ivy League certainly, student by the name of Gary Trudeau. And it goes on to win a Pulitzer Prize?
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about how it depicts the war in Vietnam, because one of the primary characters, after whom the strip is named, Brian Doonesbury, is in fact a very gung-ho National Guardsman.
It's, you know, there's a lot of interest because of the fact that when Trudeau's illustrating the strip, he's definitely taking that political angst from the time. You know, he's injecting that into the strip, and it's a way for him to talk about what he sees as a very, you know, in Trudeau's case, you know, and if Mr. Trudeau is listening, I apologize if I'm getting him out of context, but the indication that you get from reading a lot of that stuff is he's very much against the war. He's trying to talk about some of the propagandistic issues that are being presented at that time and saying, oh, no, this is false. You know, and that's why you get the character who is gung-ho, but at the same point, there are a lot of people who are not happy with the war. You know, you look at the historical, background behind it. You know, for a long time, people were either for the war or ambivalent towards it. You know, it's after 68 is when people really start changing their mindset about it, and a lot of that is because of media, you know, for good or for bad. And one of the reasons why, you know, Trudeau resonates with so many readers is because of the fact that it's not necessarily humorous, it's a lot of satire, a lot of biting satire. And that's one of the reasons why he ends up being recognized as, you know, as an influence on society. Now, going back to Malden, Malden actually won two Pulitzers for his illustrations as well, one of which was done in Stars and Stripes, the 44 piece, showing German troops being issued back to the lines, and you can't tell who looks more exhausted, the German soldiers or the American ones escorting them. And then he actually won a Pulitzer for his political cartoon, which dealt with the assassination of Kennedy, and it showed the Lincoln Memorial, and it shows Lincoln with his head in his hands, you know, just showing the angst of the country.
Brilliant piece of editorial cartooning.
Yeah.
Totally captured the American spirit. So we go forward, we win the Cold War, or the Russians give up, hard to tell at times. There is the post-Cold War period, and what has happened to comics since that time? Because there have obviously been some changes, and the emergence of a variant, the illustrated book. Talk a little about that.
The graphic novel, the original graphic novel, the idea was that it would be a self-contained standard comic. Is about 32 pages. A graphic novel normally has at least 96. The idea is that it could tell a complete story. In recent years, from a marketing standpoint, it's been great because now you can get people who are, you know, they can pick up the entire storyline, which is, for them, it's rather interesting. The graphic novel is also interesting in the modern context because of the fact that now you start to see people using it as a form of reporting or a form of historical analysis. You have the idea of the 9/11 report, the illustrated report from Sid Jacobson and Ernie Colon coming out, and then the War on Terror. The idea is that they're trying to put this into a graphic novel form, but at the same point, they're taking very real, very current topics and attaching them to a visual medium such as comic books. Joe Sacco, in recent years, has become very known for a lot of his work as an illustrator, but primarily as a journalist. So he uses the visual media as a way to tell the story of what's going on as he sees around him. The graphic novel is also a way for people to be reintroduced to some of the earlier comic books. DC, amongst the major companies, DC has now reissued all of their Sergeant Rock comics from the 1950s and 60s and 70s. You can buy them all in bound graphic novels. They're technically not graphic novels, but you can, you know, people can explain that whole issue later on. But the idea is that now you can start to read the entire story arcs, and you can start to understand how characters develop at times. So that's an interesting, you know, aspect to it. David Axe is another one who recently came out with a couple of graphic novels, one of which was called Warfix, and he talked about the idea of being a journalist trying to cover the Iraq War in 2003, and from a psychological standpoint, he becomes a war junkie. It's the adrenaline rush of being in a combat zone, which is good and bad at the same point. And then his follow-up book, which was called War is Boring, talks about the fact that he's, in a way, he's kind of developed a fix for it, and that led him to sometimes go to more dangerous places to try to both report, but at the same point, you know, satisfy his urges, shall we say. So in recent years, there have also been some great developments as far as trying to tell the story of what's gone on militarily. Dwight Zimmerman and Wayne Van Zandt did a wonderful adaptation of the Vietnam War in a graphic novel format. You know, it's, and again, it, you know, should it be taken entirely as the definitive history? No, but it's a great starting point, especially for those who might not know about the history of Vietnam. What led us to it? How does the war develop? What goes on? You know, so a lot of these graphic novels that have come out in recent years are really a way to allow readers a chance to explore history, at least on a superficial level, and then go from there. So it really is interesting. And there's stories from Afghanistan, there's stories from Iraq, there's a publishing company that actually does the entire Cold War series, including the Cuban Missile Crisis. So you do see a wide variety of graphic novels and comic books out there. So you just always have to look. So.
And of course, here we are. It's coming up on the Christmas holiday movie season, and I mean, you can't swing a dead cat in a Metroplex without going and hitting people coming to see comic-based movies. I mean, it's right now, DC and Marvel own visual media. They own television. They own movies. And they're owning a real big piece of the internet as well. Could you have imagined when you started being a comic book fan that they would come back and be the dominant source of content in the entertainment business right now?
No. I can understand it, you know, again, because, you know, comic books, they're able to be picked up by movies very quickly. You know, the storyboard concept within the movies, you know, is very adaptable from the panels that you see in comic books. And, you know, you go throughout history, I mean, you know, there were serials of Captain America during World War II. There was the Superman television show with George Reeves at one point. There, you know, so you always see that comic book tie-in to television and media, but at the same point, yeah, you kind of think it would have, you know, abated. But I think that especially with modern visual effects, it's actually heightened a lot of these stories. So now they want to go back to them and say, okay, well, you know, we can actually take this basic storyline from a comic book, and now we can really just juice it up and make it, you know, far more exciting than ever before. But at the same point, you can go back and look at some of the other the stuff that was done a while ago, and you just, by today's standards, you just cringe. There were three prior Captain America movies before the one that came out in 2012. Anyway, but the first two that came out were in the late 70s with Reb Brown, and they were pretty much made for TV movies, and they were not particularly good. I mean, they were good attempts, but just you'll watch them, and they're pretty hokey. The 91 Captain America movie that came out, they did all kinds of weird things to it. You know, made Red Skull an Italian, and you're like, what the hell is this? You know, so, I mean, there have been some good adaptations, and there have been some horrible misses, but at the same point, yeah, definitely you do see that connection between the two media, and it really does blend itself rather well in many regards.
And let's face it, who among us has not loved that original Captain America, the first Avenger movie, where not only was it a wonderful adaptation, as you pointed out earlier in the show, but it even made fun of itself. I mean, the fact that, you know, there's Captain America essentially being a chorus girl and making movies, and when in fact, of course, he is this amazing secret weapon if he can just get his ass over to Europe and get in the war.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, you look at a lot of this stuff, and it's so bizarre to look at it in one regard, but it's so amazing in the other. You know, you just see how everything is kind of developed over time. So,
well, we're coming to the end of this, and I guess the question now is, what's next for you, sir? What are you gonna what are you writing? What are you working on? What's next for you and your comic book fixation?
Okay, well, I am actually working on a couple of projects right now, one of which is my wife and I are working on a paper involving food in World War II and the idea of food as a part of the popular culture fixation on that. So there's one aspect of it. I'm actually doing a review of the Pacific for a book entitled Living Room Wars, the idea of depictions of war on the small screen. And then from one of the other projects that I'm just starting to look at is the depiction of African-American soldiers in newspapers, one of which in particular dealt with a guy by the name of Ollie Harrington, who did a series of one-panel cartoons for the Pittsburgh Courier and for the Chicago Defender. So I'm kind of looking into that realm as well. So that, and I'm always looking at other aspects of things. I wouldn't mind doing a paper on World War One cartoonist. That's been kind of in the background because of the centenary of the war itself. How far that goes, I don't know yet, but, you know, it's always something to look at. So I'm definitely trying to keep myself busy, and, you know, hopefully everybody finds this book both informative as well as, you know, entertaining and somewhat, you know, unusual. So I enjoyed it. I learned a lot in the process, and, you know, and so hopefully everyone else will do the same, so.
Cord, thank you so much for coming on today, and hope we get a chance to talk to you about some more of your interest in the future. Again, ladies and gentlemen, the book is Comics and Conflict from the U.S. Naval Institute Press. Cord Scott, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure and an honor. So,
and hopefully we'll talk again soon. Take care, sir, and have a great day.
Okay, thank you.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. It's been a busy week. We appear to have gone to war again. Over at the White House, as we're talking right now, there's a ceremony going on for a World War II veteran who's being awarded the Medal of Honor, a delayed Medal of Honor. And over in Britain, they're celebrating Battle of Britain Day. It's a heady time to be thinking about the military around the world today, yesterday, tomorrow. And we'll be here next week to talk to you about it again. Have a great week. Take care, listeners. And come back again to hear us on Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming. I never loved a soldier until the walls of war. I thought about
cherished freedom. Freedom never cries. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my the song to a dead man, to me. I never loved a soldier until there was a war. I thought about tomorrow till my baby hit the floor. I only talk to God when somebody's about to die. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her. Anything at all. You can cry for her, die for her. There's a baby on the doorstep, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop. Pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.